KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pittsburgh, California.
Oh, I'm not from the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Coming up, how will the late Mayor Ed Lee be remembered?
5 years from now, people will realize that San Francisco is way more affordable than it otherwise would have been because of Mayor Lee.
When it comes to housing policy, his legacy is contested.
A handful of tech billionaires invested in San Francisco a decade ago, and Ed Lee chose to dance with those people.
A deep look at Ed Lee's approach to housing. And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
Morning, how are you?
There's no comparison between the prices here and the prices near the wharf.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. As the mayor that presided over a wave of gentrification and displacement in San Francisco, Ed Lee took a lot of heat from the public. But he also won re-election with 55% of the vote. Since the affordable housing crisis was the number one issue during Lee's time in office, his policies around housing are likely to define what he's remembered for. And there's vastly differing opinions about whether he did more bad than good. KALW's housing reporter Liza Veal brings us this look back.
Ed Lee was, I would argue, one of the most progressive mayors in the history of the United States. 5 years from now, if not sooner, people will realize that San Francisco is way more affordable than it otherwise would have been because of Mayor Lee.
That was Randy Shaw, who's worked for low-income tenants for almost 40 years with the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. He's got a much rosier view of Ed Lee than people like Supervisor Aaron Peskin.
Let's be honest, a handful of tech billionaires invested in San Francisco a decade ago, and Ed Lee chose to dance with those people, paving the way for the tech takeover of San Francisco.
Peskin and Shaw both champion working class people's right to housing in San Francisco, and they have pretty contradictory views of Lee's record on that count. One big fault line is this. Lee believed that the public and private sectors could make mutually beneficial deals when it came to housing and beyond. But progressives and people at risk of being priced out often feel their interests are incompatible with the interests of the private sector and wanted their mayor to be more antagonistic towards what they see as the forces of gentrification. To see how this played out over Lee's term, we're going to start at Mid-Market. It's a neighborhood known for blight and vacancy. Lee saw it as an opportunity to create prosperity for the whole city.
There's Twitter, there's Dolby.
Today, this stretch of market is a strange mix of abandoned-looking lots and high-end retail and restaurants, many of which have struggled to stay open. A bunch of housing is getting built, but most residents have yet to move in. So the fate of this neighborhood is still very much up in the air. I head inside a new condo. The lobby is vast, and all the sofas are empty.
There's a vending machine with just bike maps of San Francisco, antiseptic health ointments, and like bicycle repair gear.
There's a walkway so you can get from the condos to restaurants without ever going outside.
I didn't even know this was back here.
Randy Shaw, who's nearby Tenderloin Housing Clinic, receives a lot of city funds, says the investment in Mid-Market was long overdue.
No other mayor had wanted to tackle that because it seemed like a loser. Mayors don't pick losing fights. They pick winnable fights. You know, he took a big risk that no other prior mayor would want to take.
San Franciscans are probably familiar with the Mid-Market controversy. Lee and his supporters say the neighborhood would never have changed without the tax incentives the city gave Twitter and other tech companies. And with those companies come highly paid workers who live and spend money in the neighborhood and pay taxes to fund needed services. But it also puts the existing tenants at risk.
It is true in San Francisco, economic good times are often bad for some tenants because it leads to speculation, evictions, higher rents, etc. But economic bad times also lead to eviction.
Shaw points out that a lot of social services located near Mid-Market have more funding to help people now than when Ed Lee first took office, thanks to both greater tax revenue and donations from the companies.
So everyone seems happier when the city has more money.
But clearly, plenty are not happier. People like former city supervisor John Avalos argue that Lee sold San Francisco out when the city subsidized mid-market businesses instead of raising taxes on them.
His defense was, well, in order for us to grow the economy, we have to give these breaks to big businesses. Well, another part of it is these big businesses had also, you know, done a lot to make sure he got elected.
Lee did lead the way on passing a big bond for low-income housing. He expanded eviction defense funding, and he renovated a lot of existing affordable housing. But Avalos maintains that he could have done all of this at a greater scale if he'd taxed the private sector more aggressively. He believes San Francisco was in a position to drive a hard bargain with businesses. Instead,
they weren't taxed in any way that would allow the city to do anything more than just keep the lights on.
Ed Lee's trademark was an emphasis on practical cooperation and compromise to solve problems. You can hear this in a speech he gave in 2015.
You know, for too long, deeply held and honest ideological differences divided all of us. Some say we're not tough enough. Others will say we're not compassionate enough. Some will say we spend too much money. Others will say we haven't spent enough. Well, it's time to reconcile these disagreements, not to set them aside, but to work through them.
Avalos says in practice, Ed Lee's focus on compromise meant looking for win-wins for the private and public sector. It's a sharp contrast to the way progressives talk about standing up to big business. So instead of raising taxes on companies, Ed Lee gave them the good PR of making donations. Instead of investing in affordable housing first, he invested in economic development like mid-market and promised it would generate revenue for housing later. Or with the next big piece of his legacy, pledging to nearly triple the amount of new housing that the city historically builds by easing the approval process.
This executive directive will provide the structure for an unprecedented amount of housing production by reducing project approval levels by nearly half of what they currently experience. Those of you who are investors should smile about that. Your money is not held up.
Lee's pro-growth stance delighted the new YIMBY, or Yes in My Backyard, movement that sprang up during his term as mayor. But it was unpopular among San Franciscans who think the only housing we should be building is nonprofit or publicly financed affordable housing. Randy Shaw is with the YIMBYs on this one.
The people who vehemently oppose market rate housing, which is a lot of activists on both the left and the right, never forgave Ed Lee. They blamed him for gentrification as if San Francisco was an affordable city prior to 2011 when he took office. Complete nonsense.
Pro-growth activists like Shaw argue that gentrification would actually have been worse without all the new construction. But even though more supply brings down market rate rents, they remain wildly unaffordable for most of the workforce. Of the nearly 5,000 units built in 2016, only 802 of them were subsidized affordable. To Avalos, low-income housing didn't seem to be as urgent of a priority for Lee as keeping the developer and business community happy.
If you're saying that your goal is to create more affordable housing, okay, let's do that. Let's do that in the strongest way possible. But if your goal is to actually grow the economy and bring a little bit of funding to address a political issue like affordable housing and you don't build enough of it, then you got a problem.
Save San Francisco.
And that's the view of plenty of San Franciscans today.
We, the working class, can be using it for what?
Housing.
Housing. We can be. They want to use it for office spaces.
More than a month after Mayor Lee's death, protesters marched from the Mission down to Mid-Market, pledging to block tech offices from moving into a building they want used to house low-income people at risk of homelessness. People like Brian Paul Reed.
I've been living in the place since 93. Section 8, everything.
Now he lives on the street near Market.
There's a lot more money here. There's a lot more people with money.
Though state and federal policies are behind a lot of the homelessness in this country, the development encouraged by Ed Lee also put people on the street. The city increases services, but new people continue to become homeless. Daryl Greer also lives nearby.
The city services suck.
Ed Lee's main response to homelessness was opening 4 new navigation centers, shelters with fewer rules designed to navigate clients to long-term housing. Though Greer says,
navigate you through all the red tape. It takes you all inside of the red tape.
And so,
and this is where I ended up after 5 months.
City records have shown he's not alone. Fewer than a quarter of clients end up in stable housing because there's none available. The city doesn't raise nearly enough money to supportively house everyone living on the streets.
All the people that you see on these streets have been through the navigational center. It has failed.
Lee's homeless department has managed to keep San Francisco's homeless population flat, even as new people lose housing. They do that through prevention and rehousing, but also with bus tickets. Every year of Lee's term, nearly 1,000 homeless people left the city with a free ticket elsewhere. Lee's critics point out that when fighting for poor San Franciscans came into conflict with the interests of the private sector, he tended to recede from leadership. For example, when his backers in the tech industry funded a proposition to ban homeless tent encampments, or as Airbnb illegally took scarce housing units off the market. Inequality worsened during his term. Whether his policies could have prevented that or not, the calls for a new approach will be loud in the run-up to this June's election. Out of the four frontrunners, only one, London Breed, is likely to run as an heir to his unfinished work. For Cross Currents, I'm Liza Veal.
Liza is our housing and homelessness reporter. You can reach out to her at housing@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
Morning, how are you?
Okay, this is a Filipino squash. You can saute them with pork.
There's no comparison between the prices here and the prices, you know, near the wharf.
Do you think you recognize it? To tell you more, here's KLW's Asal Ehsanipour.
It's Saturday at 5 a.m. I'm in a massive parking lot at the intersection of 101 and 280. All around me, farmers unload dozens of crates of produce. They wear headlamps to light their way, arranging the fruits of their labor in concrete stalls.
And then this right here is the watermelon radish, and then the pink one is the Japanese radish.
Each Saturday starts something like this, here at the Alamini Farmers Market.
Chinese eggplant, Filipino eggplant, we just have a green eggplant.
I count 20 customers already lined up at C and Z Vegetable, run by the Zhang family from Del Rey, California. One exuberant shopper comes from Walnut Creek.
Okay, my first name May, M-A-Y.
May Ling, May for the Mayflower. What's she buying?
Oh, everything. See my backpack?
It's filled to the brim with veggies, fruits, and eggs.
Okay, this is my playground.
Her playground.
When I see the fresh fruit or veggie, for me, I like shopping in the Tiffany jewelry store. I'm not excited about department store. I'm excited in the farmer market.
Amalia Martinez helps manage Alamini Farmers Market.
And that was it. I've been here over 30 years.
And she starts each Saturday with breakfast here.
I always have cheese, one tortilla, and coffee. I buy the cheese from Spring Hill Cheese right here at the market.
Amalia runs the program for EBT, what used to be called food stamps, and she coordinates 80 farmers. As Amalia guides me through the market, I see farmers wearing thick coats and gloves.
I think we're off to do our market tour, right?
Okay.
Okay.
Amalia is tiny, but I struggle to keep up as she weaves through customers,
pointing out the produce.
Look at all the squash, different kinds. Zucchini, yellow neck.
Or her farmer friends.
Florita, this is Gloria. She's been here for almost 30 years. Avila Farms. And she comes from San Joaquin County.
Florentino, ba?
There are about 700 farmers markets across California, but growers from nearly every part of the state come to sell their produce here at Alamini.
Butte County.
Stockton, Monterey.
Tehama, which is close to Oregon.
Even Riverside in Southern California. One reason for all that travel? Alamini Farmers Market was the state's very first.
Our farmers market was founded in August 12, 1943, during World War II.
At the time, all aluminum was going toward the war effort, so canneries across the state closed. That meant rural farmers had a surplus of fruits and vegetables. Because of gasoline rationing, city housewives couldn't travel to faraway farms for home canning either. So farmers offered to bring their produce directly to customers in San Francisco. This was supposed to be a temporary thing, maybe just a week or two, but it was so successful that the city of San Francisco officially started managing the market, which it still does today.
The farmers have been coming for over 70 years.
The market faced plenty of opposition in its early years, especially by grocery stores who saw a dip in sales. They even took the matter to Sacramento. But the people of San Francisco voted to give the market a permanent location, and it's been here, on Alamini Boulevard, since 1947. The longer I'm here, the more I realize there's a reason this idea stuck. This market has a rhythm, a pulse, something that's kept it a city staple. Many of the farmers themselves have been selling here for generations.
I'm working here for 30 years.
My wife and I, we've been doing it for almost 20 years.
I want to say 30 years. Let me just make sure how many she knows exactly. Ama, mom, ¿cuántos años han estado aquí?
32.
32 years.
Amalia tells me it's not just the farmers who've been here forever. I meet Tom Pugh and his wife, Jacqueline Morey.
I always like to say that I came here before I was born because my mother was pregnant with me when she came.
Jacqueline's been coming here ever since.
If we're alive and in the city and not terribly sick, we're here.
If you'd visited the market when it opened in the 1940s, you might have seen some Asian American farmers. But most were Southern Europeans, lots of Italians. Today, a walk through Alamini is like a visit to the United Nations. There's a medley of Latin American and Southeast Asian ingredients tough to find anywhere else, like fresh ginger and bitter melon, even sugar cane.
Sugar cane? It's sweet. Like eating for fun.
Compared to other farmers markets in the city, Alamini's prices are really low. But farmers are eager to sell their produce here. Even the winter off-season has a waitlist of farmers vying for stalls. How does this make business sense? Farmers told me they can sell large quantities of produce at retail prices. They also hire family to keep costs low. Plus, the market limits the number of farmers selling similar produce. That increases variety and reduces competition.
Look at McGuinness. Look at all the sunflowers.
On our market tour, Amalia Martinez says, usually, a farmer has to retire before a space is available. But even then, a family member might take over.
My name is Sandy Garcia, and my dad started the farm in 1968, and he recently retired.
Sandy and her niece Sarah have been running McGuinness Ranch for about 2 years, but farming's in their blood.
I grew up on the farm, so I started driving tractor when I was 9.
And Sandy's sister used to bring Sarah to the market in a playpen.
And Sarah's here today still as the farmer. Yes, I have it.
Sandy and Sarah arrange their booth before handing off sales responsibilities to Rose Bratt.
Rosita, no es televisado, solo es escrito lo que van a...
Rose is a little bit of an Alamini celebrity, with nice earrings, lipstick, and recipes to share. Before working at the market, she was a regular customer. At the time, Rose was a wedding caterer who bought her ingredients from Sandy's father.
He used to make sure that he get the strawberries with the long stems, you know, because I used to decorate with strawberries.
That was 15 years ago. She's since switched from customer to employee. Rose and I are interrupted when some of her favorite customers show up. One of them is Sherry Gendelman. She says she woke up at 4 a.m., did her exercises,
had my chai, and rushed to the market so I could get here by no later than 6 o'clock.
Like she's done for 25 years. Sherry knows everybody, like Mark and Nibby from Two Dog Farm.
Mark will stop and have a political conversation with you. Almost any minute, he'll just stop in the middle of whatever he's doing.
Or Jan Snyder's.
By the way, the honey guy is back. Maybe he's 85, 90, and he was repairing something on a ladder, fell off, and really injured himself. Now he's back, and his honey is spectacular, particularly the sage and the blackberry honey.
The honey guy is too busy to talk to me, but I do learn that after his injury, he needed some help at the market. So Rose of McGinnis Ranch volunteered. As Rose is telling me this story, she gives my shoulder a squeeze.
It is just a family, this market. You feel like everybody's your family.
You have delicious persimmons today. 6 pounds for $10.
Grace Teresi of Miramonte Farm and Nursery agrees.
The farmers themselves have a camaraderie. They're very competitive, but at the same time, we're amicable and we're concerned about each other. So when someone like Glenn has a heart issue, we're all worried about him. When Fumi had cancer, we were all worried.
She's talking about Fumi Kimura, who sold flowers here before she died of cancer a decade ago.
Customers, too, came to her house all the way till her passing. It was quite an incredible experience. Yeah, it was really heartbreaking and yet heartwarming.
Catherine Valentine is a longtime Alamini customer. She says these exchanges, they're significant.
Like you have an interaction that has soul, you know, has meaning, and hugs. I get three hugs a visit, at least.
She says her kids love this market as much as she does, especially the woman they affectionately call the mushroom lady.
She would give them mushrooms. They would sit and eat the raw mushrooms. I mean, just like one after another, like candy. They've grown up with her.
I want to meet you to meet Hobi, Far West Fungi.
Hi. Amalia introduces me to the mushroom lady, Toby Groney.
It's kind of, you know, the whole life is out here. I definitely don't see my personal friends on a weekly basis, but I do see my customers on a weekly basis, and those people have become my friends.
Amalia tells me the market sees over 50,000 visits a year. But bustling as it is, it's also located on prime real estate that's empty, except for this farmer's market on Saturdays and a flea market on Sundays. Some worry the city, which owns this land, might want to develop. In the mid-90s, when an affordable housing project was built on a nearby hill, opponents feared that housing would destroy the market. Here's customer Tom Pugh.
It would be awful if this market ever closed down. There's always that threat that they want to close it down and put in housing. So it's something you live with that never goes away.
But I talked to Amalia, her boss, and her boss's boss. All three said the city has absolutely no plans of shutting down the market. And frankly, I think Amalia would be devastated if she ever lost her relationships with her farmers.
I love all of them. I see them as family, and it's part of me.
So Amalia will be here again next Saturday morning with her chosen family here at Alamini Farmers Market.
I'll be waiting next week.
Yes.
Next week.
In San Francisco, I'm Asala Sanipour for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Asal. Well, there were no winners this week, but if you have an idea of where Audiograph should record next, give us a call and tell us. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And And that's the show. Today's Cross Currents team includes Angela Johnston, Marisol Medina Cadena, Nina Gensler-Debs, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega Welch, Andrew Stelzer, Bo Walsh, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins, Jackie Sajiko, and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This is San Francisco's Balkan Brass Ensemble, Inspector Gadget. They perform at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco this Saturday night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.